I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice. Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, hello, hello. This is a different type of scoop as we start off this week. We usually have scoop on Monday, and I miss seeing you on Monday because unfortunately I was not well. And although I have the bad habit of working through illness, I could not actually achieve that at this particular time because I literally could not sit up in bed. And I thought, you know what? They deserve better than that. So we're not going to do scoop on Monday, although it pains me to do that in so many ways because we had such a big news weekend. And I hate missing you on a Monday morning when we can just get prepped and ready for the week and kind of get in order for what we're watching for. So if we don't want to follow every single breaking news headline during the week, we have a foundation for what's going on. And that's one of the whole purposes for Scoop. By the way, if you're a first-time Scoop listener or Scoop member, welcome. We really appreciate your support for Smarter News. You are a key part of building a solution in news and quick, concise, nonpartisan news. That's an investment. I mentioned this on social media this weekend and it just came out, but I felt like it sounds right. This is an investment in your sanity during a time where there's a lot of media clutter. So I really appreciate you. Thank you for your flexibility this week. And as I did learn in live television, when I used to work in that medium, you know, you would get really prepared for a 2-hour live program and that was your time. That was it. You only had this time. And let's say there was a senator I was interviewing or ambassador, like there was a really big interview I was looking forward to. It was going to make news. You know, I had all my questions ready to go. And then something would happen. You know, at that time in news, it could be a car chase. It could be suddenly bad weather. You're going to show the radar and suddenly you get pulled in a completely different direction, newsworthy perhaps, but not what you were intending. And it could be really disappointing because all you wanted to do, all I wanted to do was do that one interview that I'd worked so hard to prepare for. And then it all just goes away in a moment. But what I learned during that time is that in this way, live news was very zen. You had to be very present and understand that being present was happening for a reason. And there would be another moment. And undoubtedly, I saw this consistently, that when an interview didn't happen. It took me a couple years because I would get frustrated. But when an interview didn't happen, it wasn't supposed to happen. I had a question that would have been completely wrong, or I read something inaccurately, or it wasn't going to be the moment that I thought. And so that's sort of a lesson for life too. I try to embrace that, but it's hard when you're running your own business. And this is a show that we want to make sure that we regularly do for you. So again, thank you for rolling with the punches. There were so many breaking news stories over the weekend. And what's interesting is that they look entirely different here on Thursday morning. So actually the quality of the scoop that we're going to get today, I believe actually is the one best suited for us this particular week. And also know that I am completely open to your feedback about what works for you. If doing a mini scoop on Monday is best, and then we do a follow-up that's maybe a little heftier scoop later in the week, or we do two scoops that are medium size, see how we're playing with this, we could do any of that. This is ours to create together. And I'm excited to do that with you rather than tell you this is what you're being served. That's what I would prefer. So I'm excited. I'm excited for today. And I'm going to start off our broadcast completely different than any other news program you have seen this week. And I have my four-year-old to thank you for that, because my four-year-old has suddenly become fascinated with the Titanic. Strange, I know, but my four-year-old is sort of an eccentric child. Love all my children, but my four-year-old has he's very funny. He listens to things and he comes up with things you wouldn't even realize. The Titanic is one of those things. So over the last couple of months, he's been asking a lot of questions about the Titanic, and my husband and I can't figure out why. Why is he asking about the Titanic? Well, maybe his brother said something. My husband was in the Navy. I mean, who knows? We have older children. So, you know, you never know who the younger child's like left to fend for himself. We have no idea what he's interacting with on a regular basis beyond our purview, with our older kids talking about what they're seeing in school. They're in second and third grade. So it's not anything terrible, but it's one of those things. When I asked, the reason why I'm telling you this, though, we finally got him to focus and ask, True, his name's Truett, True, why are you talking so much about the Titanic? And he said, Mama, it's Big Sky. And I said, what is he talking about? Big Sky, Montana. We were traveling last summer in Big Sky, Montana. And in Big Sky, Montana, when we were there, was the moment that we had that breaking news story about the submersible that had that horrible accident going to the wreck of the Titanic. My son was 3 at the time. But this came back up, it surfaced. So it obviously left an impression on him. Anyhow, this led to our entire family taking a closer look at the Titanic, which has been rather fascinating. And it's important to point out, look at the cross-generational fascination with this. My four-year-old's fascinated with the size of the ship and is trying to wrap his head around what happened. But I am a mother of 3, and I'm fascinated with the size of the ship and what happened. Why am I mentioning this? Because this weekend, April 14th to the 15th, is the anniversary of the Titanic sinking. And I was going into this weekend thinking about how we could cover that at Smarter News, because I think you too still may have some questions about the Titanic. And so I read this book. It's called A Night to Remember. It's a fascinating account by Walter Lord. It's considered one of the premium top accounts of what happened with the Titanic, because he was able to interview survivors that were still alive at the time when he was doing this book. And so he pieced together investigations, he talked to survivors, and the way that the book is reported essentially is it goes through each hour, each minute of what happens just before they strike the iceberg until they are finally coming to New York. And it's a very interesting look at the press. What Walter Lord talks about for the Titanic is he says, this was the biggest news story perhaps ever. This was the biggest news story of the time. I would argue it's still a story that so many people are fascinated with. And I'll tell you a little bit about why in a second, but here's how I would like to tie it into what we're talking about today and why I think it matters. We don't have any, you know, brand new discoveries about the Titanic at this very moment to share, but there was a very interesting account as I was reading this of what happened when the Titanic struck that iceberg. What was the experience of people on board? What did it feel like to them? Here's a couple of descriptions by people that were actually on this ship. Some describe it as a jarring motion, a grinding jar to some. It was quick. They didn't really know what to make of it. Some came outside and wondered what was happening. One person described the breeze outside his half-opened window just suddenly stopped. He didn't really feel anything, but the breeze seemed to change and he couldn't explain why. One woman described that her swaying dress just stopped swaying, but she too didn't feel that grinding, jarring motion. One person was laying down, happened in the middle of the night, and they describe a still mattress suddenly. Remember, the ship is rocking as they're going along, and suddenly it's stillness. What comes out mostly from the accounts is this great silence that came over the ship. Not a crash and a boom and a bang, but this great silence that settled over the sea. And someone somewhere knew something was off, but many were told nothing was. The reason why this stood out to me is that was not my impression, certainly from the movie that so many of us have seen. I imagine this huge crash and this huge feeling and this instant fear, but that wasn't the case. And it's a great lesson when so many of us feel like we're the authority in the moment. These were facts. It was true. These were true feelings by people. They truly felt a jarring motion or a grinding jarring, or they had a feeling of something happening. They truly felt something was off, but they couldn't really explain it. These were true in the moment. These were facts in the moment. But those facts and those feelings in the moment did not reflect the whole story. They had no idea, so many, that they were about to become part of a historic moment. And reflecting on that as a journalist in these times, I think of all of our experiences where our feelings and our experience in the moment is valid. It is factual. It matters. But we have to remember we may not have the authority of the complete time that we're in. And we maybe don't see the complete story in that moment. And I thought, what a lesson to be affirmed in what you're feeling and to trust that, and also leave room for a developing story. And that's what I walked away from this book. Such an incredible account. I cannot recommend it more. If you're at all interested in looking for a good read, this is the one. It's, again, A Night to Remember, the classic account of the final hours of the Titanic. It's a great work of investigative reporting and writing. And certainly, there are still questions. For example, we don't have a final number of those that perished that night. We always say more than 1,500. Why is that? Because the U.S. investigation said 1,517 people died, but the British investigation said just over 1,500. I believe 1,503 or 1,505. I can't read my writing here, unfortunately. But there's a difference still. There's no finality on that. We know that there were 2,200 people on the ship. So I think that's a way that we should approach the news too. Our feelings and how we're reading a moment matter. They're valid. These voices that we're going to hear today, they matter. Their experiences in Congress or in leadership, they matter, but they may not be the authority of what's really going on with the story that we're experiencing together. And we need to leave some room for that, especially during this election year when a lot can happen. So this particular sort of analogy really feels appropriate for this past weekend, doesn't it? When suddenly over the weekend, we see news of hundreds of missiles and drones being fired from Iran into Israel, a historic attack that we've never seen before. We've never seen Iran fire missiles and drones from its territory all the way over to Israel as a form of attack. We've never seen that before. We've seen different terrorist groups that the United States believe are supported by Iran, do something similar and attack Israel. We certainly believe that was the case on October 7th. That is the American account of what happened. The Hamas-sponsored terrorist group attacked people in Israel. But we've never seen this sort of escalation. And in these moments, no one knew what was going to happen. Israel is a nuclear country. If those bombs and drones started to hit, what was going to happen? What was the scenario of what could happen there? What do you think would happen in your state if there were 300 plus missiles and drones fired at your territory? Israel is not much bigger. It's often compared to Delaware. It's not much bigger than that. So think about that for a second. What was the possibilities on the table? It seems like that's been sort of brushed over in the moments and the days that have followed. And part of the reason for that is that there wasn't an incredible amount of damage. Few of these missiles or drones hit into the territory because of Israel's defenses. There were no significant injuries or casualties. Casualties can include injuries, by the way, or deaths, despite this barrage. And Now, a few days later, we haven't seen a significant response or a like response by Israel. And so what does it all mean? The reason why this attack matters is because it's historic, because it's a break. This is a break in behavior by the Iranian regime. It's really important that we know that. This is the first. Will it be just a one-off? Will we see something similar this weekend? How much will be tolerated before the attack comes back to Iran? What is that going to look like? These are really big questions that we need to still ask. And yet, the story almost is absent from the news. This is a story that could significantly change every single news story I will talk to you about today, whether it's border security, inflation, the housing market, your availability of fruits and vegetables. It could affect everything. And yet, it's kind of like, well, no one got hurt. We'll see what happens next. You know, there's some condemnation by different countries, and the United States has tried to ramp up some sanctions. But other than that, we're not really seeing anything else. Here's a couple things I thought were notable. And in just from a press perspective, because that's something else that we like to do at Scoop, let's take a look at just what was available to the media and also how the press is approaching this story. You know, one of the things I was watching for is, would we see an official address by President Biden? Would we see him step to the microphone, any microphone at all? It would be really significant if it was the Oval Office in the White House, but let's just say any microphone and have a statement on camera. We saw photos of him in meetings, but we didn't see that. That was notable to me. It was a sign that there was a reason for the United States not to try to address this head on in that particular way. I thought it was very interesting that the press, and we talked about this recently, the Associated Press, who's a major newswire service in the world, the editorial standards that they set, many people follow. This is a time that their editorial choice not to use the word terrorism in a consistent way. They like to use it sparingly because they say it's politically loaded and it can be used in a political way. And what some people consider terrorists or terrorist groups, other people do not. And so they prefer the term militant. We don't like that at Smarter News because we think militant is too broad. I think it's way too broad. I think you catch a lot of people that do not support terrorist groups in that. And it's unfair. I also think it's really important that even if you make that editorial decision, that you report that the United States believes that Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism. Iran has had that designation since 1984, so 40 years, many different administrations, Republicans and Democrats, and that many of the groups that Iran is affiliated with are also designated terrorist groups. In this particular reporting, there were very few mentions of Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism. This is a terrorist state attacking one of our key allies, but that's absent from the news. In fact, the Associated Press, in one of their stories, quoted one of Iran's military members as calling the United States a terrorist state. But absent from any context in that story was the fact that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is also a foreign terrorist group as designated by the United States. But the Associated Press did not report that. I think that's really notable in the way that this story now is delivered to the public, because I think it's important for you to know. What you do with that information, totally up to you, but I think it's important for you to know. There was a complete sort of brush off in the press because there were no damages or deaths significantly. There's still hundreds of drones and missiles, and there was no tie to the fact that Iran has been sending these drones to Russia to use in Ukraine in a very effective way. But Ukraine doesn't have the Iron Dome and the defense system that Israel has. So they've been using them. They've been practicing with them in Russia. And that's the relationship between Iran and Russia, but we didn't really hear too much about that. So these are some of the things I think we have to consider. And again, here we are on Thursday, and we're just not really talking about it that much. Even I just kind of was looking through the news today. Maybe I missed something. You know, the United Nations is talking about things, but as far as something super consequential, we're not really seeing that. And we're certainly not seeing a lot of attention on it in a significant way from Congress. So as people are, you know, our leaders, our elected leaders are stepping to the microphone and they're talking about any number of things. They're talking about other things. They're talking about impeachment of the Secretary of Homeland Security. They're talking about budgets and funding. And that's one way that we do see a tie into Israel, because one of the aid packages that's going to be on the floor in the House has to do with that. And so Without much more to report, I just wanted to give you that little overview about why this attack over the weekend matters. And if we see something else, this is what to watch. Do we see a more effective attack by Iran next time? Do we see any additional attack? Is this just done? We're in a real period of what's next. And I think we need to acknowledge that. And at Smarter News, I want to make sure that we do that. So if you have any questions on that, I really look forward to talking to you more about that. And for those of you who are watching live, please go ahead and put them in the chat and we'll pull them up. I want to transition here, though, to talk about what we are, what seems in front of us, and that is our money and what actually happens with our money, because that's what's ahead of Congress today. We had a historic impeachment come to an end. We'll get to that in a moment. We have a historic trial happening in New York City of a former president. Those are history-making items we're going to get to. But I just want to give you a quick cliff notes of what's happening in Congress at the moment, because it's your money. And that's one of the big jobs of Congress, is to figure out what to do with our money. What should we actually do? And so Speaker Johnson, who has the majority in the House of Representatives, remember, no taxation without representation. So the House of Representatives is critical when it comes to taxation and how they're going to spend our money, how it's going to be allocated. He has now put forward a string of different aid packages. He's been under pressure because there are Republican voices, loud voices, that say that he's not really following a Republican agenda, that he's putting foreign aid first because that's really what the White House wants and that's not what Republicans want and they don't like it. And some of these critics of Speaker Johnson maybe don't want him to lead anymore. And so if you recall what happened with the ousting of Speaker McCarthy, there's a question, could that actually happen to Speaker Johnson? Could we go through that again as a country where suddenly the House of Representatives is without a speaker, which means it cannot do anything until it elects a speaker, which means everything's paused. Foreign aid, everything would be paused. So here's what Speaker Johnson has done. He has decided to put foreign aid into separate buckets, almost like, let's make it fun. It's almost like a sampler, you know, if you get like a tasting menu, there's like different drinks to choose from or like different bites to pick from. There's Israel's aid package. There's Ukraine's aid package. There's Taiwan's aid package. There is the border somehow going to be amended potentially into one of those packages, but we don't really know how. And what he's saying is everybody gets to vote their own conscience. They get to reflect their own districts, even Republicans. And he has to say that because he needs Democrats to come across the aisle to support some of these plans in order for them to pass. He believes these aid packages are critical and good for the United States economy because we're replenishing weapons to Ukraine, which means that we're investing in companies here at home. This is what he says, and investing in our allies while also figuring out a way to sort of attach border issues to it. Some Republicans are like, hey, no, we need our own border aid bill. And the House actually did pass one a while ago, but the Senate's not picking it up. So they're trying to figure out how do they kind of like scoot that stuff in to make some Republicans happy and also achieve their agenda. We'll see how this goes. This is going to be a new strategy, but because it's your money, I think it really matters. I want to show you, I picked about equal time from both the Speaker of the House, Speaker Mike Johnson, and Hakeem Jeffries, who represents the minority, and he's a Democrat. So Speaker Johnson, Republican, Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat. I want you to hear from both of them about how they are approaching. So they have time at the microphone yesterday. They could talk about whatever they want first. And I want you to hear how they're setting up what they want the public to hear. So here's Speaker Johnson.
The American people understand the open border is by design. It was designed by this administration. They did this intentionally. These are policy choices. It began on the first day that Joe Biden took office. And we documented in the House 64 specific executive actions, from executive orders that he took to actions that Secretary Mayorkas implemented that opened that border wide. And that is what's led to this catastrophe. And that is why we're in such dire straits. We have, by our estimates, probably 16 million illegals that have come across that border since Joe Biden took office. 16 million people. The official number is a little over 9 million encounters at the border. We know that that includes at least 340 suspects on the terrorism watch list that were encountered at the border. But the dangerous thing, the scary thing to a lot of American people is we don't know how many terrorists came in totally undetected. We know we've got over 2 million, probably close to 3 million gotaways that have been documented, but we don't know who's come in over those open, completely unpatrolled sectors of the border.
So notice the focus. he wanted to talk about the impeachment of Secretary Mayorkas, which at this time is now done because the Senate decided not to go through a trial. So basically, the articles of impeachment were dismissed and there's no trial of Secretary Mayorkas and the impeachment is over. He is still impeached, by the way, Secretary Mayorkas. He's impeached in the House, so he will go down as in history as someone who has been impeached, similar to former President Trump, who was also impeached but not punished or removed in a trial in the Senate. So just to be clear on that. So this is what, again, the Republican leader of the House trying to put forward these aid packages talks about the border before talking about these other issues. So let's take a listen to Hakeem Jeffries now.
For months, America's national security interests have been put on hold and undermined by a group of extreme pro-Putin Republicans who are determined to stop us from standing with our allies across the world, and in particular, the Ukrainian people, who have fought bravely and valiantly in defense of principles like democracy, freedom, and truth. The time has come for the House of Representatives to act, and act decisively in America's national security interest.
Extreme MAGA Republicans. So you see there's a positioning of both party leaders in the House to talk about the other party in a negative way. You have Speaker Johnson saying, hey, this is a whole setup at the border. This is intentional by the Biden administration. Hakeem Jeffries is saying this is intentional by the Republicans to turn their back on our allies and democracy, freedom, truth, all of these things that are values, these big values. So you see how they're setting each other up. In the meantime, they have a lot of work to do. And they're going to have to figure out, are they going to pass anything? And right now, I think that's what the big takeaway is. Why does this all matter? It's not only your money and how it's being spent. There's a question about, will anything actually get done? Now, whether or not it should, we could do monster debates on any of these particular issues about how does, you know, what does foreign aid look like and what way is the foreign aid given? And here's the key. There's going to be amendments to each of these bills that are being put forward. So what they look like now, I don't want to say isn't almost not worth looking at. It's worth looking at, but they could significantly change before we can see if they could possibly pass. And even if they pass the House, we don't know if they'd pass the Senate. So here we are, still in a very familiar place. There's no additional aid going to what is key priorities to some. And there's also no additional aid going domestically to the border, which is a key priority for others. Just want to just share this really quickly with you. This is interesting. Andrea just asked this. If they have a gotaway, do they chase them or let them just go where they go? The estimates that Speaker Johnson were talking about, it's really important to source that to House Republicans. We have certain data that we're going to look at. I'm going to look at it with you in just a moment. That's actually the reported data from Customs and Border Protection, but there's estimates all over the place. In some cases, and we've talked about this in the past, so I'm sorry for being repetitive, but I think it's important. What Border Patrol has seen is human traffickers are leading big groups, let's say a group of 100, 200, 300 people across the border in a very remote area. They're doing that on purpose because those people are going to be confronted by Border Patrol and they're going to need to be processed. And it's going to tie Border Patrol up for several hours while the cartels and others go the opposite direction. In some cases, Border Patrol will see people and say, I can't get to them. There's 10 guys, you know, in other cases. So we're kind of working off of like loose estimates. For example, another loose estimate is of the total amount of people that are going to be encountered at the U.S. southern border every month. We can say, well, 50 to 60% are going to be not allowed to stay. So we're working with these very loose estimates. So I want to show you this. This is a couple things just quickly before we move away from the impeachment. So big overview again. Secretary Mayorkas was impeached. The Senate said, we're not going to go further with this. The Senate has the majority Democrats. So the Democrats were really speaking out strongly against this impeachment. Senator Chuck Schumer said that basically this was an argument, a policy argument by Republicans, not an impeachable offense. Remember, Secretary Mayorkas was impeached on the grounds of essentially lying to the American public, not being honest about what's happening at the border, and also for not enforcing our existing laws. That's what Republicans said. He denied it. So that's also important. So Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's like, this is policy. This isn't impeachable. Now, Republicans in the House disagreed, so they impeached Secretary Mayorkas. Senator McConnell, who's the minority leader, and a Republican in the Senate, got up yesterday and said, this is the worst precedent we could set because it gives a opposing party the power to basically take an impeachment for the House and say, yeah, well, we're not going to go forward. And it's an interesting comment because it doesn't matter what side of the political aisle you're on. Impeachment has come up way more frequently in the last few years. And some would say in a political way, others would say in a valid way. The question is, how did the founders intend to use impeachment? How rare should it really be? And how are we defining it as a tool in politics rather than a tool of the people? So that debate continues. We don't really have a ton of policies or rules completely mapped out about impeachment. Let me just give you an example. I mean, we have an idea of what's supposed to take place, but the articles of impeachment from the House are walked over to the Senate. And I was like, why do they still do that? I mean, they could just hit a button. They could text it. Why do they do that? Well, it's actually a tradition that dates back to 1868 and the impeachment of President Johnson. And in fact, one of the lawmakers was so ill, he wasn't able to walk. So they carried him and carried the articles of impeachment to the Senate. And so that's part of a tradition that was set in place as impeachment was happening. But you know, nothing in the Constitution is like, you need to carry that, always carry it by hand, but it's part of the tradition of impeachment. And we saw that this week. So I always like to give you a little bit of history. One of the things that I think is really important, despite all of these different political stories that we're seeing, is that we actually got border numbers that no one's talking about. And these are real numbers that give us a real idea of what's happening at the U.S. southern border. Granted, data is only as good as data is, as it's collected. So this is what we have. This is what we use. And I think it's important for you to see that this is also what lawmakers are seeing. So this is for March. The big number that we know is in, 6 months, we have 1.7 million encounters at the U.S. southern border. Sometimes those are repeat encounters. So encounters does not equal a new unique person each time. But it's important to know that that's a very high number. I remember, if we go back to, 2021, when we started to see more than 200,000 encounters at the U.S. southern border. And I believe we saw that as well. In 2020, the border was closed. So it's not a great comparison, but now we're getting used to these high numbers, but we know enough from our reporting at Smarter News that it always hasn't been that high. And so we're talking about 250,000 people coming in to the U.S. border, being encountered in some way by Border Patrol. And going back to our question by Andrea, these are what we know. We don't know how many people total came across the border. We only know what we know. And that's where there is a great unknown of, well, what is actually happening at the U.S. southern border? I hope to have an interview last week by someone that's been able to spend a lot of time down there. So what you should know for last month in March is that it's very consistent to February. It's very consistent to January, which is better than December when we almost had 400,000 encounters at the U.S. southern border, but it's still very historically high. In the first 3 months of this fiscal year, we had about the equivalent of San Francisco's population encountered at the U.S. borders. That's north and south. So this is a huge issue. It's not going away. Despite the different aid packages and political happenings in D.C., I want you to see these numbers and know this is very much going to be an issue going into the back half of the year. It's, as you see from Democrats speaking in the House of Representatives, wanting to speak about foreign aid, this isn't something that necessarily the White House wants to speak about. This is something that Republicans really want to speak about. They feel like this is a winning issue for them. And arguably, they have a point in what they saw in the 2016 election, when former President Trump came out very strongly against the border. And that was perceived as one of the ways that he was able to gain momentum. So it's definitely something to watch. Speaking of the former president, I'm going to get there in just a moment. And it's an interesting story that I actually need your help on. So I want to give you a little bit of what's happening with the former president and why it matters to everybody. Again, no matter your political perspective, but also share why it's a very interesting editorial quandary that we find ourselves in. So let's turn to that. That's going to be our last thing today. And I appreciate you guys as we're going a little bit longer than usual. So what's happening this week regarding the former president? We're seeing history being made. We know it's historic that a former president, as well as a presidential candidate, in this way, being charged with any criminal charges is historic. We've never seen a former president criminally charged, facing prosecution, going into an election. We've never seen this before. So anyone that acts like this isn't, they have an expertise on this, just a reminder, no one has any idea exactly how this is going to work out, what takes place, and when does he have to be somewhere, and when does he not, and what does this look like? So quick review, President Trump faces four criminal trials. There are two federal cases against him. Those are going to be tried in Washington, D.C. and in Florida. And there's two state cases, one that's going to be tried in New York and one's going to be tried in Georgia. What we're looking at right now is the case in New York that is often referred to as the hush money case. This is regarding payments that President Trump made going into the election of 2016. The payments in and of themselves are happened. The question is about whether or not he accurately reported these transactions. That's why it's called the hush money case. So what's interesting to know about this is not necessarily illegal to have a settlement with someone and pay them to not say anything, but you can't lie about it and you can't hide it. You have to, if you're a business person, especially, you got to make sure if that money is tied to your company, for example, it's recorded. Now, I don't have any, it would be a great question. I need to get more of an expertise on hush money. So if anyone's out there and wants to volunteer we just went through tax season for the right way to put a line item on that. How do you do that in QuickBooks? I don't know. I don't have the answer for you today. I'm going to try to find it out. I should know that. That's something I should know. I'm going to make a note. This is what this trial is about. So President Trump denies that there was anything illegal done here. These are legal fees, he says, but others disagree with that, obviously, and he's facing criminal charges. This is the first time, so we say, oh, he's the first former president charged, but this is the first time we've seen a case actually start. So this is why this matters. This case is actually moving forward. He's actually in court. It's happening. They're picking jurors. This is actually going to take place. And some believe this trial, and it's hard to know, because delays could happen. It could actually conclude and we could have a verdict before the November election, which in other cases, it may not be the case, which again, opens up a whole other can of worms about whether or not if former President Trump wins, what does that even look like? Whew, we're going to have a lot to talk about. This is why I appreciate you guys on Scoop. So what's important to know is that when it comes to federal criminal trials, we have no cameras and recordings. So that's off the table. We know we're not going to get that. But states are a different story. In the 1980s, the Supreme Court had a ruling that said essentially that cameras could be allowed depending on the states, like how the states wanted to address it. They weren't going to make some sort of declaration about cameras in the courtroom. And so every state has a different rule that they're following. For example, this is how we're still able to see footage from the O.J. Simpson trial. It's because in the state of California, a judge can use their discretion about whether or not to allow cameras or not. How many cameras? What does that look like? So judges have the discretion. That's how we were able to see the footage from O.J. Simpson. How about the Casey Anthony trial in Florida? That might be a familiar one for some of you. Again, a criminal trial here. You know, one of the first states to review cameras in the courtroom was the state of Florida. They were allowed, again, in this particular criminal trial. Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, that was a big case. It's actually a civil case, not a criminal case, in the state of Virginia, and the judge allowed cameras there. But in New York, there are no cameras. Despite all the cameras in New York, the number one news market in the country, arguably to some, one of the top media environments in the world. No cameras, no audio, no exceptions. It's not going to happen. So we don't have any of that from inside the courtroom. So we cannot see what happens. I cannot share with you recordings of what's taking place. I can't give you an idea of the prosecution and the defense. I can't give you really both sides of it. I can't give you the tone of the judge. And this matters. Let me play a soundbite because President Trump is coming out after each day in court and he's making a statement to the press. Let me give you an example of one of the things that he said this week.
My son has graduated from high school and it looks like the judge will not let me go through the graduation of my son who's worked very, very hard. He's a great student. He's very proud of the fact that he did so well and was looking forward for years to have graduation with his mother and father there. And it looks like the judge isn't going to allow me to escape this scam. It's a scam trial.
So this is very interesting, right? Hearing that, I mean, again, regardless of how you feel about former President Trump, you could think, oh, that's too bad. You know, he can't see his son. But it sort of depends on what happened in court, right? If the judge was like, no, you're not seeing him, you know, or was there, you know, something that was said that said, hey, this, it would be a double standard. This is an ongoing criminal prosecution. We can't allow you to take a day off to go to your son's graduation. You know, you see the tone of what happened inside the court could be very informative in this particular situation and could kind of change your idea of how President Trump may be framing it. Maybe, maybe not. There are some recordings that are happening for the overfill room for journalists that are able to be present there, but I don't have access to that. And I'm not going to be able to see it for myself. And you're not going to be able to see it for yourself. And that's always something that I want. I really am grateful for the journalists that are going day in and day out to this court. They're going to be in court for months and we're going to rely on them and we are grateful. In fact, I'm going to make a note. We should reach out to one of them and talk to them. That would be really important. Just what is it like? What is it like inside these courtrooms? What does it feel like? Those are some of the things that you're able to see on camera and you're not going to be able to see any of it. There was a report this week, and this was actually, I think the Associated Press uses this as an example. They were pointing out this camera issue in a write-up that they did. And I guess someone was watching former President Trump, and during the proceedings, the person was describing him as falling asleep. So the question is, was he really falling asleep? Because if you're talking about a sleeping former president, that's a pretty vivid image. Is that fair? Is that actually what happened there? You know, so you see how this could be potentially a very big story this election year. And we were sort of cut off from access, not because of the judge in this case. This is because of New York. And there don't seem to be any changes on the horizon. There is a state senator who's trying to make a change here because he's arguing, hey, the public should have access particularly to this trial, but really the public should have access because New York is the media capital and it doesn't make any sense anymore. So we'll see. What would be the reason for not having cameras in the courtroom? By the way, like why would lawyers not want that to happen or what would be the reason not to? There's a question about whether or not jurors could be affected by it. You don't see the jury, obviously, but people are don't like being on camera or the threat of being on camera. And prosecutors, any lawyer, prosecutors and defense attorneys have argued that it could affect the case, the way the case is presented or told. And listen, when you're on camera, you could say something super smooth when you're not on camera. And then suddenly you get on camera, I'm speaking from personal experience, and you can't pronounce your own name. I don't know why that happens. It could be very familiar words, and still you're just like trying to get them out. So I actually do think there's an interesting argument about not having cameras in the courtroom to make it really about that space. But if it's of public interest, then what's best for the American people? It's not really what's best for the lawyers. It's what's best for the American people. So I'm very curious your thoughts on that. You know, what would you like to see it? Would you like that? Would you like a live stream? And here's where I could really use your help. How do you want this case covered? Do you think a weekly quick video highlight would be good where I talk about some of the things that happen in court? Do you think it's sort of a when it matters, why it matters, which is our motto here at Smarter News? You know, just tell me about it when it matters. I don't really need an overview. It's historic. So I feel a great responsibility that we make sure that we cover it, but it's also a story that we've heard about now for 8 years. So you're also as far as news value, I don't know how much news value there's going to be on a regular basis. So I'm very curious what you would like when it comes to this. This is going to matter in this particular part of the election season, and it's going to make an impact, not just because former President Trump can't go to his son's graduation. It's because during the day, he's not going to be able to campaign. He's going to be busy. And so, yes, he could fly all over the country and do as much as he can at night or before, but he's going to be off the campaign trail for now. And that gives the Biden team some breathing room. It also gives them the microphone. And it'll be interesting to watch how both campaigns navigate this moment. Does it kind of, I want to say, turn down the volume of this election season simply because there's not going to be quite as much? Or does it do the opposite? Because the Biden team looks at this as a real opportunity. And the Trump team also looks at a real opportunity. Step to these cameras after the court. You're the only person that gets to be on camera, really, unless other people choose to, and drive this home that this is a sham trial, and get your messaging out every single day, because we can't help but record the former president who's running for president again if he steps to the microphone. We're going to watch. We have to, for news value. It's important. So I'm very curious what you all think. Maggie said maybe an inside reporter once in a couple of weeks, but a recap would be sufficient. And Melissa, this is a great point. Body language and tone add to the words that are said. Live stream would be valuable. I do agree here. I really do agree. Sometimes I didn't entirely, you know, buy in, and I maybe regret this about the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp story. Everybody else did. I was looking for other stuff. I probably made the wrong decision there, because it was great fascination with that. But there were all sorts of reasons. I was like, I don't know. I just don't know if I can do it. Sometimes it's just having extra support. So thank you for your support. Can I show you this to you just as we end? We're going to kind of bookend this. I did find us going back to this beginning idea of what we're experiencing matters. Our reality matters. The facts matter, as all of us are experiencing, whether it's Speaker Johnson, right? Leader Jeffries, former President Trump, President Biden, these perspectives really matter. The question is, what is the bigger story that we're seeing? What is the bigger story that we're experiencing there? Do we have our finger on it yet? Or is it something that we're not quite knowing? Remember with the Titanic, it was just a matter of hours before the whole ship sunk. They went from not feeling anything, some of them, not everybody, some of them went from not feeling anything in complete silence to a nightmare scenario in just a few hours before the sun rose. And it just is a reminder how quick things can change. The BBC in 1957 did some interviews with a group of survivors. I meant to play this at the beginning for you, but I think it'll still work here. Let me just play a minute of this. I want you to hear for yourself one of the survivors speak.
And now let's take up the story from survivors of the Titanic themselves. First of all, an American passenger, Miss Edith Russell, traveling first class. Where were you just before it happened, Miss Russell?
In the library. The steward had just called out, 11:30, lights out. So I gave him a few letters to post in the morning, told him I'd pay for the stamps, picked up a book and walked forward to my stateroom, which was on the same deck, A11. And as I got in my stateroom, I switched on the electric light, and I noticed a slight jar, followed immediately by a second one and a third one, which was quite strong enough to make me hold on to the bedpost. The boat came to a full stop. I walked forward to my window and saw a grayish white mass drifting by. I was very much surprised and decided to take my fur coat and go out on deck and see what it was all about. Well, when I got out on deck, I noticed the gentleman standing by the rail and several people in a large, again, this grayish mass. I said, what on earth is that? That? Oh, madam, that's a lifeboat. Oh, that's an iceberg. Iceberg? Gracious, I've always wanted to see one of those things since I was a child. Well, you're seeing a corker now. There's 1/8 above the water and 7/8 below. And believe me, that's some iceberg. So, after that, we picked up bits of ice, played snowballs for a little while, and it was very, very cold. I asked one of the officers if there was any danger. He said no, and I went back to bed.
Think about that. No danger at all. They're playing snowball fights, and she just went back to bed. I was looking real quickly here. I wanted to make sure I had my math correct. This is from 1957. So just for context, the woman that was speaking 45 years after the event. I'm sure she's told this story many times, but I'm also curious in the ways that it may have changed too. Again, it just gives us an idea of what we're experiencing in the moment may not reflect the bigger story that we're part of. So A Night to Remember is the book that I mentioned at the beginning. I think we're in a moment of time that we're all going to remember. We've already been through it together. I think if we step away from the last several years, we know that. And I really appreciate being able to deliver news to you in this new way and for your support, because without you, this couldn't be possible. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to many more live broadcasts in health for all of us in the weeks and the months to come. Please let us know your feedback. We love your voice memos. It's easy to pick up your phone as you're taking a walk, you're in your car and you have one question or you have a comment, record it. We'll play it. We don't need to share your last name or your social security number or anything like that. It's just nice to hear you. Just like it's nice to see a live court proceeding. It's nice to also hear from you and get your voices as part of the broadcast because you are here who we're here for and we really appreciate it. So that's the scoop for this week. We have a lot of these developing stories, especially these matters of the House, are expected to go through the weekend into early next week. So we're probably going to revisit them and we'll continue to watch what's happening on the foreign affairs front and make sure we stay updated on that. So questions and comments, always let us know. Scoop@smarternews.com. And I'll always see you with more at smarternews.com. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks for your support. And we appreciate you so much. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news. And we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.